Cypress Casino versus Blagojevich, Mr. Andelman, or Mr. Gray, I mean.
They're changing of the guards.
Yeah. What? Cast of thousands.
Yeah.
Good morning. Yes. As a quick housekeeping matter, your clerk requested that I inform the court that I intended to have 4 minutes of rebuttal time rather than three on the sheet. May it please the court. My name is Bill Gray, and I'm joined by co-counsel Rafi Balabanian, and we represent Mr. Blagojevich. This case is before this honorable court on appeal from the Northern District of Illinois, and accordingly, the district court's failure to grant Mr. Blagojevich legislative immunity must be reversed. There are two overarching points that I'd like to make today. In federal court, federal legislative immunity governs federal causes of action. And secondly, governors who sign legislation into law without any inquiry into their motive are entitled to federal legislative immunity for suits asserted personally against them. Quite simply, there is no basis for treating Mr. Blagojevich differently than all other government officials in similar circumstances who have made an assertion of legislative immunity. Accordingly, and no federal court has held differently, that in federal court, for a federal cause of action, federal legislative immunity analysis applies. Under that analysis, when a government official, regardless of the branch of government, and also irrelevant of their motive or intent, acts legislatively, he or she is granted federal legislative immunity for those actions. Central District, excuse me.
Acting legislatively, that means signing the bill that was passed by the legislature?
That's one act that's legislative. As the Supreme Court said in Bogan.
Well, the one we're worried about here is that, isn't it? Its signature?
Specifically, yes, Your Honor. It's analogous to the situation in 84 in Tillins that you wrote. There's a sphere of legislative activity, and signing a law is the quintessential legislative activity. A law cannot get passed aside from a veto override.
This is a strange sort of law, though.
It is, Your Honor, but the Illinois Supreme Court has already found that while it was a strange law, it was passed for legitimate reasons.
I don't think they acknowledged that it was a strange law.
You're right. That's my acknowledgement and yours as well. But they did find that the introduction of the casinos, the riverboats, poker tables, and card gaming would take away from jobs and funds that would go to the horse tracks. Thousands of jobs are created by the horse tracks in Illinois each year. And the five largest
just
grossing...
Just cleaning up the effluvia takes a lot of jobs.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Just cleaning up the effluvia from a horse race.
It certainly does.
This may be part of what we're involved in.
It certainly does, but there's a lot at the casinos as well.
I've lost the thread. You're representing Blagojevich?
Correct, Your Honor.
So your issue is just the immunity, not the nature of the statute, isn't it?
Entirely, Your Honor. I was just responding to Judge Sykes.
Well, but my question is related to the immunity. Because the character of the act core inquiry in whether this is entitled to legislative immunity. And if this is not a quintessentially legislative act, then he doesn't get immunity.
Right, but there is no act that is more quintessentially legislative in nature than signing a bill.
Yeah, but hasn't the state Supreme Court said that he has no legislative immunity as a matter of state law?
Your Honor, you're referring to Jorgensen, I imagine, as the appellant relied on.
Hasn't it?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. Jorgensen was a state court challenging the state constitutionality of a state law. In Jorgensen, the Supreme Court explicitly said that legislative immunity was not proper because Blagojevich was sued in his official capacity, not his personal capacity. This was explicit by the Supreme Court. In Jorgensen, Ann Jorgensen, a state employee, was trying to get her COLA, her cost of living increase that Governor Blagojevich had vetoed. She sued not only Governor Blagojevich.
No issue of legislative immunity in that case?
Legislative immunity was asserted in his official capacity.
I don't understand what that means.
Well, when
personal, what's the difference?
Well, 95.6 million dollars in this case. In Jorgensen, Governor Blagojevich was being sued in his official capacity, as was the Comptroller of Illinois. Ann Jorgensen properly sued both of them, as she was required to do, overturn this veto.
Was the court saying there's no legislative immunity for anybody if you're sued in your official capacity? Is that what they're saying?
Your Honor, they did explicitly say that.
Well, yes or no?
I think no is the answer, Your Honor.
So if legislators are sued in their official capacity, they have no immunity?
Legislators specifically do, and the court seized upon this.
But then if the governor doesn't, then the court is making a distinction between the legislative immunity of legislators and of a governor.
The court narrowly did define this, though, as part of its checks and balances analysis.
And what you're talking about. Look, you say the governor has legislative immunity. And in this Jorgensen case, the court said legislators have legislative immunity, governors don't.
Explicitly when sued in their personal capacity.
What difference does it make? Why would he have immunity in his personal capacity but not his official capacity when that distinction isn't made for the legislators? They have immunity in both capacities, right?
The court didn't specifically
don't
rule on that.
Legislators have... Are you going to say the legislators have immunity in their official capacity but not their personal capacity and the governor is reversed?
Certainly not, Your Honor. Certainly not, Your Honor. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What you're saying, I don't know what your argument is.
Your Honor, Jorgensen...
Legislators have, under state law, the legislators have immunity sued in their official and presumably their personal capacity. And the governor does not have immunity in his official capacity, but you're saying he does have it in his personal capacity?
Correct, Your Honor.
Why?
That's under state law. Regardless of...
Well, I know, but that's what I'm interested in, because I don't understand why federal law should give an official, a state official, more immunity than the state law does.
Because, Your Honor...
These immunities are for the protection of these officials. If a state doesn't think a particular official needs the protection of immunity, why should the federal court?
Your Honor, I think that while it is certainly important for the protection of the personal individual, it goes to the system. We don't want judges and juries inquiring into...
The state of Illinois doesn't mind having judges and juries interfere with the officials. Why should a federal court? Why should a federal court protect states when this against lawsuits that the state doesn't care about?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court...
Don't say what the Supreme Court says. Tell me what sense that makes. Suppose Illinois says, we don't like these immunities. We think officials should be suable just like everybody else. Well, if a case happens to be brought in federal court, why should they have more immunities? Why should the federal courts give state officials more protection than the states want them to have?
Your Honor, I would have 2 points. One, I don't think that the state court said that.
Yes, I know that's your position, but suppose they did say that. Then what would you say? Would you still say there's a broader federal immunity?
Your Honor, this is a procedural matter.
Why would you say there was a broader federal immunity?
Because the Supreme Court has explicitly...
No, that's not an answer. That's an appeal to authority. I'm interested. I want you to tell me whether there's some reason.
You're trying to appeal to authority. So.
Right.
When it's on your side, it's...
That's all you have, right? Yeah. You have a reading of a Supreme Court case. You don't have any reason for this distinction you're urging.
No, Your Honor. The distinction is clear, and the reason is clear.
What's the reason?
This is since 1951, this area of law has been unchanged.
No, it's not a reason. What is the reason? As I say, why should a federal court give more immunity to a state official than the state wants the official to have?
Because, Your Honor, there's different actions in federal court, and federal courts are the only courts that can arbitrate what immunity is proper. This is a federal cause of action. RICO, the state court should not be the interpreter of a federal cause of action.
No, it's one thing to say the state shouldn't grant a broader immunity than the federal court, because that might frustrate federal enforcement. But why should a federal court grant greater immunity to a state official than a state wants to? How can that advance any federal purpose?
Because it's a federal cause of action.
I know, but why? How does it help a federal cause of action to remove a defendant by an immunity rule? That weakens the federal cause of action.
I disagree, Your Honor. RICO was not in no way abrogated legislative immunity. Therefore, RICO...
That's a completely separate point. The point is, when a federal court is trying to fashion an immunity rule, why should it give anybody more, a state official, more immunity than state wants to give it?
Simply because it's in federal court, and I disagree.
Okay, we have no answer.
Okay. With the court's permission, I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
That's fine, Mr. Gray. Mr. Andelman?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Robert Andelman. I represent the Empress Casino and the other plaintiffs' casinos in this case. We do take a different view of the case than Mr. Blagojevich does, but with your permission, I'll address the legal issues raised by that appeal after discussing the issues raised in our appeal, which is 093975. My clients filed this lawsuit because they are uniquely the victims of the pay-to-play politics that are described in the complaint and that are described in the indictment against Mr. Blagojevich and others.
Well, you can sue for damage. I don't understand how you can sue to get your tax payments back.
Well, Your Honor,
30% back. I don't see that.
We aren't suing to get our money back, and I think that the place where we lost the district.
Well, but under RICO, you can get damages, right?
We can get damages under RICO.
So what do you need the constructive trust for?
We need the constructive trust because the windfall from the conduct, from the underlying conduct, is going to the racetracks, and right now, not all the racetracks.
We're suing the racetracks, right?
Well, we're suing two of the racetracks under RICO. We're suing all of them under constructive trust.
Why don't you sue them all under RICO?
Well, the reason we didn't sue them all under RICO is because right now we have a substantial quantity of evidence that two of the tracks participated in the RICO conspiracy. And it may be that as the case goes forward, we'll learn that all the tracks were involved in the RICO conspiracy.
You need the constructive trust, I see, for the racetracks you haven't sued. Okay, then I understand. But I really, you know, it's an obnoxious statute, but how is it different from any other earmarked tax, right? The Medicare tax, it's earmarked, can only be spent for Medicare benefits. How is that different? This is being spent for horses instead of old people.
It's different in two ways. It's different in two ways. The first way it's different.
You can't tell the difference between it's old and Chinese pork.
It's different in three ways. The first way it's different is that it was bought and paid for. The first way it's different is that we have a body of evidence that the act was rejected twice by the General Assembly in Illinois, and then a bribe was paid.
Does that relate
and then
to the
passed.
Tax Injunction Act? I mean,
well, the second reason is that unlike a typical earmark in which money is gathered, put into a fund, like the ones that the appellees cite for hazardous waste cleanup or public...
about Medicare.
Right. Okay, well, for Medicare.
Right.
But none of those statutes involve a direct transfer of wealth from one private citizen to another to be put in that private citizen's personal accounts. And I know they're going to get up and...
Wait a second. Look, in Medicare, you have federal income tax, which is paid very unequally, right? A lot of people don't pay any federal income tax. Rich people pay a lot, you know, and the rest... Some people cheat and so forth. Okay, and all that money is then put in a fund, and it's only available for Medicare benefits for people over 65, right? 65 and over. So those, you know, and the rest of the community doesn't get any benefit from it.
But the way that money is paid out, Your Honor, is someone receives medical care, and then that provider makes a claim to Medicare, and then Medicare pays for the service. In this case, the money has all been distributed. We know now that the $76.5 million that are subject to the preliminary injunction are in...
I don't understand that.
Your Honor, they're in their private accounts. Medicare
fund is available to the Medicare providers and so on, and just the way this is available to the horses and
Your Honor,
the racetracks.
It's quite, here's how Medicare would have to work to be like this statute. I get $50,000 from the government. I put it in my bank account, and the government says, you can use this money for health care or to otherwise operate your life, because that's what they get. They get money, and they're told you can use it for
a
list of things.
That, of course, sounds like a health savings account.
Well, and that's a little bit what this works like, because this money gets transferred to them entirely without really controls on how they use it. Medicare, there is, as this court will know, having heard so many Medicare appeals, has a lot of
restrictions. You don't have a legitimate tax unless there are controls on how the recipients of the tax, of the benefits, the subsidy. I mean, taxes subsidize all sorts of people.
I don't
right?
think it's a. Well, as you know, I don't agree
standard.
That it's a tax, and it's not standard. There isn't any statute like this that calls for the state, the government, to collect money and within 10 days distribute it as cash
to private
parties.
Is 10 days? Is that going to be the line? Are we? What worries me about your position is that it opens up the. It opens the door to challenges of all sorts of tax and transfer programs because they're atypical. That's disturbing to me.
I guess I don't see that it does. And this statute is unique. It is different because it involves the transfer of cash. In the Medicare context, the state assumes certain obligations that they're going to make payment in exchange for services. This isn't like that. In this instance, cash is collected and cash is distributed.
The government, as part of the stimulus program, is sending a check this year, $250, to every Social Security recipient in the country.
Really?
Yes. Because we're not getting a cost of living increase, so the president has decided, you know, pathetic old people like us, we need something, so we're all getting a check for $250, obviously paid out of tax money or, you know, out of the, so what's that? We're not required to account for it or do anything for it, or it's
well,
just
let
the
me,
present.
Let me bring
is that up. Is that not a tax? Can that be enjoined by?
Well, let me bring it back to the Tax Injunction Act. Because I think we can debate the wisdom of this and how it's structured like other taxes or not like other taxes. There's a reason.
Wait a second. That's your big debate. Now you're abandoning it.
It's not our big debate.
Look,
you're on our first point in our
the
brief.
The Social Security recipients are getting the $250. It's just a pure transfer. It's completely political. And are you saying it's not a legitimate tax? It can be enjoined?
Your Honor, this is the issue on the Tax Injunction Act. Is it revenue neutral? Is it revenue neutral?
$50 already.
Is the injunction revenue neutral to the state?
What does that mean?
It means, does it cost the state anything? Does it impact the fiscal operations of the state? That is the controlling question on the Tax Injunction Act. Because the reason we have a Tax Injunction Act is because the railroads were refusing to pay taxes, the states were cash-strapped, and they felt like, and the states were so cash-strapped, and the railroads were tying things up in federal court, they needed to settle,
but
they would compromise their tax claims.
It's not neutral just because it's earmarked. Just because the state says we're going to spend this money for some particular use, are you going to say that because of that, it's revenue neutral?
I'm saying it's revenue neutral because it doesn't
look,
cost
what
the
taxes
state.
Do, it takes money out of one group's pockets and it puts it in another group's pockets.
No.
Right?
No.
Well, what do you think this Medicare thing is doing, right?
Your Honor,
taking $13 billion out of the Treasury and it's giving this to Social Security recipients.
The state assumes obligations under the Medicare statute, and that is
no,
why.
No, it doesn't. You're thinking of Medicaid. There's no state involvement in Medicare.
The federal government is assuming obligations, which means that if the money was it's not, Your Honor, if you let
this
me.
This is not Medicare. This is Social Security. Social Security recipients are getting $250 this year. Nothing to do with Medicare.
Your Honor,
what was your point?
Thank you, Your Honor. My point is that this injunction that we seek, the equitable relief we seek in this case, has zero impact on the fiscal operations of the state of Illinois. That is why, when the state of Illinois was present in court, it had no objection and it never intervened. The TIA has never been applied.
It's a considerable embarrassment. But if the state still wanted to support these horses and racetracks, they'd have to dig into some other source of funding.
Well, that would require entirely different legislative conduct in an environment that is no longer polluted by the corruption that we contend existed in 2006.
Issue is different from the tax injunction issue, unless you want to say there's an exception in the Tax Injunction Act for
tax injunction issue comes down to this.
Why do you bring in the corruption? Why do you bring that?
Because the court raised the contingent possibility that if the state wanted to nonetheless fund the tracks, despite an injunction in this case, that it would have to pass a new law. And that's true, it would have to pass the new law. I don't think it would happen. The point is the injunction in this case would have no impact on the fiscal operations of the state, and because of that, it doesn't implicate the Tax Injunction Act. That's what it is. This case is it does not impact the fiscal operations of the state of Illinois, and what the Tax Injunction Act is intended to do, what it's always been construed to do, is not to allow a federal lawsuit to tie up fiscal obligations of the state so that the state is at fiscal risk. That's not the case here.
If the tax produced so much revenue that there was a surplus, which would not affect anything the government did, would that also not be covered by the tax?
No, because it would still impact the general revenue fund or even a specific revenue fund of the state.
Impact only right. Well, they don't need the money. They
just, right. Here, the money that's at issue in this injunction is in their bank accounts. It's all sitting in private bank accounts right now. It doesn't belong to the state.
$250 Medicare, Social Security
bonus.
What are
they
going to
pay the $250, by the way?
Who's the custodian of the fund?
We should be getting it soon.
Well, the monies that are subject to the injunction right now, the tracks own it. It's in their bank accounts.
That's for the 2006 law?
That's the $76.5 million.
What about the 2008 law?
The 2008 law, that money right now is held in the protest fund. And after the resolution of the appeal, which the treasurer holds, separate and apart, and after the appeal of the facial challenge in that case, either it gets returned to us or it gets given to them. But the state can't use it no matter what.
Right. It never comes into the general treasury.
That's right.
And perhaps then a further distinction from Medicare or Medicaid is that this isn't a revenue-raising scheme to fund a government program that benefits the whole. It's about as pure a profit transfer as you can get with the state as a middleman.
It is.
And so what it's this, sui what, generis.
If there really were a Social Security lockbox, maybe that argument would hold more weight, but there isn't. It's just general revenue.
What if the state passed a law saying that 3% tax on the casinos to be used to be given to gambling addicts?
Well,
would that be enjoyable?
There's two cases that we cited that are similar to that, right? There's one from the First Circuit that involves accident victims on the highways, and there's one that involved from California that involved a fund that was created for crime victims. Money was generated, put aside for crime victims. It was a crime victims fund. In both cases, money was generated and put aside in a segregated fund. And in both cases, the courts of appeal found that was not a tax for tax injunction purposes. It served a sort of general public purpose in the sense that it's good to help people in those categories, but the money was just being given to private citizens. And so they said for Tax Injunction Act purposes, because it didn't impact the fiscal operations of the taxing body, the Tax Injunction Act simply didn't apply.
So all earmarked taxes, in your view, are exempt from the Tax Injunction Act?
No, that's not my view. My view is...
What's the difference between the gambling and the... And the crime victims and the accident victims and so on. You have a designated group of beneficiaries, and a special fund like the Medicare fund is set up for them. So what's the difference?
The difference is the impact on the state finances. So, for example, in the funds that they're talking about, this government has to build roads. So if you freeze up money to use to build roads, whether it was in the general revenue or in a special fund, you're impacting the fiscal operations of the state.
But the federal government
doesn't pay money to racetracks.
The federal government doesn't have to pay money for medical assistance to old people.
Of course, the Tax Injunction Act has no application whatsoever to the federal government. It only applies to the states.
Of course not. But suppose the state decides to participate in Medicaid. It doesn't have to. It's not required to. It decides to provide medical assistance for poor people. It doesn't have to. So if it sets up a Medicaid program, Medicaid fund, and so on, how is that different from your accident program, accidents, or, you know, or
the crime
victims?
It doesn't have to, but it does. And once it does,
it
assumes a fiscal obligation.
You thought it important that states have to build roads, which isn't true, but suppose we grant they have to build roads. They don't have to provide medical assistance to anybody, but they do.
I am, Your Honor. I will reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
You don't want to answer my question?
Well, I do, Your Honor, but my view is that if it impacts an obligation of the state, if it had an impact on the revenues of the state of Illinois, that would be different. In your hypothetical, and I admit I'm not an expert on Medicare, I'm not an expert on Social Security, but I remember that lockbox argument that President Gore or Vice President Gore made. That money is in general revenue. And we can call it a lockbox, but it isn't. And so if you freeze up that money, you are having an impact on the monies of the United States of America. This case involves an injunction over money that is in private bank accounts. It is completely different. With all due respect, I don't see the connection. I may not be following you, but I don't see it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Andelman. Mr. Feinerman?
May it please the Court, I'm Gary Feinerman. I represent Arlington Park Racecourse. I'm also speaking on behalf of Hawthorne and Fairmont. I want to first address two points right off the bat. One is the casino's suggestion that they're not suing to get their money back, and the second involves the exchange between Mr. Andelman and Judge Sykes about the money simply benefiting private entities. Mr. Andelman said the casinos are not suing to get their money back under count two. That's exactly what they're suing for. Not a penny more, not a penny less. They want to get all the money back they have paid under the Act, and I would refer the Court to page 24 of the appendix, which lays out the relief that the casinos are seeking under the constructive trust count.
That's only relevant if this is a tax.
That's correct. That's correct.
It doesn't bear any resemblance to a tax.
It does. Well, I believe that it does bear a resemblance
to
the tax. With respect to whether it benefits solely private parties, the suggestion was made that this money is simply a transfer from the casinos to the state to the racetracks. The racetracks put it in their pocket, and then we're done with it. That's definitively not what the statute says. The statute requires that 60% of the money be spent on purses, and the purses go directly to the horsemen, the folks who own the horses, and they in turn support the breeders and the trainers
purses
and the grooms.
Win.
Excuse me?
If they win.
Exactly.
Those
winners. That win. The top five in each race get
but
money.
The racetracks would be paying that out of their own pocket if they didn't get this money.
No, that's not
it's
correct.
A benefit.
The racetracks would be paying. The purses are derived from the handle, which is the amount of money that is bet on each race. But what Mr. Lano testified to, Mark Lano is the executive director of the Illinois Racing Board, and I would point to his testimony. It's in the November 30th, 2009 transcript, pages 16 to 18 and pages 24 to 27. According to the Illinois Racing Board, the 60% of the money that goes to purses will enhance purses by 30 to 40%. That's very high. That's and the amount of the purses is very highly regulated by the Illinois Racing Board.
The amount of the purses is what attracts thoroughbred racing horses to the track race, which adds to the handle, adds to the income, and so on.
That's exactly right. It's a vicious cycle.
Another former governor had that figured out, too.
That's exactly the point. It's when you have lower purses, you don't get the good horses. If you don't get the good horses, you don't get the betters, which continues the downward trend.
And all of this is to improve the breed of horses, according to the theory. Huh? Just what we need.
Not necessarily to improve the breed of horses, but to...
Well, that's the theory behind the gamble, the right to gamble, and with the original Constitution forbade gambling.
Right. You want to improve the horse. You raise the purses to improve the horses, to bring people in, to sustain this segment of the economy, which is a $2.5 billion segment of the economy that supports 37...
Gambling is a $2.5 billion, or which?
No, it's the...
The horses themselves?
It's the agricultural sector that is downstream from the racetracks, and that's in the statute, and it was confirmed by the...
Is that what? You mean the horse farms, or what?
Yes. Well, it's the...
Actually, I think it's the horse manure that's used to create the crops.
That's part of it. Those are the grooms that take care of the horses in the backstretch. But the money goes to the horse owners when they win, and then that gets trickled down to the breeders, the folks who own the mares that drop the foals. It gets sent to the trainers, the jockeys.
There are a lot of horses raised in Illinois?
Yes, there are. The number has dropped over the past few years, and that's one of the findings that the General Assembly made in the 06 Act and the 08 Act. But with respect to the 40%, again, that is directed to improving the infrastructure and the facilities, both in the front end, where the people are who view the tracks, and the back stretch. And Mr. Leno, again, testified to this, pages 24 to 27 of the November 30th transcript. The Racing Board has some very specific ideas as to where this money is going to go. And the Illinois Supreme Court directly addressed this point. The casinos made the same argument in front of the Illinois Supreme Court, said that this money, the 40%, they couldn't talk about the 60% because the 60% is going to the purses. But the 40%, they said, it's just going to go into the racetrack's pockets. And the Illinois Supreme Court directly refuted that. It's on page 21 of our appendix. Said no, it's very tightly controlled how this money is going to be spent.
Not binding on us.
I'm sorry?
That's not binding on us.
A state Supreme Court interpreting the meaning of a state statute and how it's going to work?
The conclusions about whether this is a tax or not, that's a question of federal law under the Tax Injunction Act.
That is absolutely right. But whether it's a tax under the Tax Injunction Act turns on whether the tax provides a general benefit to the public,
right,
on the one hand, or narrowly benefits regulated companies.
And that's an independent question of federal law for this court, unencumbered by any contrary view of the State Supreme Court of Illinois.
As to whether it's a tax or a fee, but not as to what the statute does. The State Supreme Court...
I don't think so. That opinion had to do with the public purpose clause of the state constitution.
That's correct.
That was one challenge. And the uniformity clause of the state constitution.
Right.
Those are extremely weak limitations on the legislative power of the state, and they're interpreted extraordinarily expansively by the state of Illinois and most other states under Supreme Court case law in most states. And that has no bearing on the Tax Injunction Act question before this court.
Again, I agree with you that it's not dispositive of whether it's a tax or a fee, but in terms of what the state statute actually does and what controls there are on the money, you have a state Supreme Court interpreting a state statute. The state Supreme Court has the final word on what the state statute means and what it does and how it works. And it would be contrary to federalism for a federal court to say, oh, no, Illinois Supreme Court, you don't understand how this tax works. In fact, the money does go straight into the racetrack's pockets, and they don't have to spend it for public purposes, and it's not really intended to benefit the state's economy as a whole, and it's not intended to go to the racing industry so that this $2.5 billion industry could be supported and 37,000 jobs saved. This is something that the Illinois Supreme Court has already decided, interpreting a state statute, and while it is not dispositive of whether it's a tax or a fee, I think in terms of how the statute works, I think the Illinois Supreme Court has the last word
on
that.
This sort of begs the question, what was the source of the legislative power to engage in this sort of legislation in the first place?
The public purpose clause.
That's not a source of legislative power. That's a limitation on legislative power. What's the source of the legislative power?
It
can only be the police power. Let me give you the answer. It can only be the police power, right?
I think the way the Illinois Constitution works is that the legislature has the power to do anything other than the powers that are taken away by the Constitution.
The public purpose clause is a limitation on the state legislature's ability to spend public funds.
Correct.
These funds never become public funds, as I understand this statutory scheme. And the uniformity clause is a limitation on the state's ability to raise public funds. And the state was never raising public funds in this case. It was engaged in a sort of middleman transaction involving profit sharing from one gambling enterprise to another.
That's not how the Illinois Supreme Court saw it. How the Illinois Supreme Court saw it is that these are public funds. That was the whole basis.
The Illinois Supreme Court never addressed that question. They never addressed the question of what the source of the legislative power was. They went right to the uniformity clause issue, and they went right to the public purpose clause issue. And those are limitations on discrete legislative activities. I want to know what the source of the legislative power is in the first place so that we can properly characterize what this is.
If you want to say the police power is kind of a general description of a state's ability to raise taxes and spend it as the legislature deems fit, that's fine. I can't quarrel with that.
That begs the question that this is raising revenue for the state.
Right. It is raising revenue for the state. And what the Illinois Supreme Court...
This isn't a state subsidy program, though.
It is.
Because the money never comes into this state.
The money absolutely does come into this state. It is in the custody of the treasurer in a special fund. There are
for
hundreds.
For 10 days.
It was for 3 years, but yes.
Well, that's because of the litigation. Right, for 10 days. The statute itself says this is a 10-day pass-through, and it goes right to the racetrack.
Let me put it this way. How the Illinois Supreme Court understood these acts is saw an industry in trouble. A $2.5 billion industry, 37,000 jobs. What the state is doing is using the racetracks.
No, the state could not muster the political will to actually write a law that spends state money on this purpose. So it structured this in a way that constitutes a simple transfer payment.
It becomes state
money. It could
never
have gotten the political will behind making an appropriation directly to the racetracks.
I mean, we could debate the public policy of whether this is good public policy or bad public policy.
I'm trying to debate the character of this statute and whether it's a tax or not.
The state saw an industry in trouble. Unemployment was threatened, and industry was going down the drain. The state found a revenue source, took the money, and is using the racetracks as a vehicle to disperse this money out to this whole industry, thereby saving it and saving the jobs. That's no different from what government does. Not all the time, but particularly in these times, government does that. It's a legitimate government function to go in and try and save industries. And the fact that the state found a particular source of money from the casinos who the state deemed responsible for the trouble in the racing industry really is neither here nor there. It was a source of money like any source of money. It goes to the state, and the state used it for a public purpose, for a general purpose. It's no different from what happened in Schneider. The state wanted to build roads.
It's very different from what happened in Schneider. Schneider was the Wisconsin Transportation Fund operates very differently than this fund. The money is collected from truckers, and it's put in the Wisconsin Transportation Fund, which and it's used to build roads, to maintain roads, and other transportation
purposes,
which are quintessentially public functions. And it's state money. I mean, it doesn't flow through to private individuals.
Wisconsin used the road contractors as a vehicle to send money and to build roads, which is a public purpose. The Illinois legislature used the racetracks as a conduit of money to save an industry to prevent unemployment, which, as Kelo says, is a traditional public purpose.
I think the analogy is very strained.
See, my time's up. Thank you.
Mr. McKenna?
Good morning. William McKenna on behalf of Balmoral and Maywood Racetracks. And I'm here this morning, Your Honors, to address one of several alternative grounds for affirmance, specifically RICO proximate cause and Fletcher versus Peck. Now, for count two of the complaint, which is the sole count under which they sought the injunction, to support the injunction, there has to be a reasonable prospect of success on the merits. Count two, as the district court found, completely derives from the RICO count. And paragraph 66 of the complaint makes that extremely clear. And there simply is no RICO proximate cause here. As the Supreme Court said in Anza, to paraphrase, the wrongful conduct alleged does not directly lead to the injury complained of. And here the wrongful conduct alleged is alleged and hotly disputed corrupt payments, hotly disputed from my client's perspective. The wrong is this tax that these casinos have been required to pay. But the fact is that both houses of the Illinois General Assembly in both 06 and 08 voted overwhelmingly in support of these two statutes. And under those circumstances, a court cannot be certain that the statutes were passed for some reason completely other than the alleged corrupt conduct.
Why isn't that a jury question?
Well, Your Honor, that's where Fletcher versus Peck comes in. I mean, 200 years of jurisprudence. And Chief Justice Marshall in Fletcher versus Peck had a case, two private parties suing each other for damages, and the plaintiff's case depended on a statute of the state of Georgia that granted legal title to these properties being declared invalid. And the allegation there was that every single legislator in the state of Georgia had taken a bribe to pass that statute. And Justice Marshall said, no, we can't do that. There are too many problems. And what will we do here, Your Honor? If we go back and we go into discovery, are we going to depose every single legislator in the General Assembly who voted for it and ask them, how was it you decided to vote? Are we going to ask every senator and every legislator? But I see my time is up, Your Honors, unless you have further...
No, go ahead.
You can finish your thought.
My thought was simply, will that be how a jury then decides probable cause? Will we have a parade of legislators saying, I voted for this law because I have horse farms in my district, or I have veterinarians relying upon me, or I thought the public purpose was a sound public purpose?
I think the legislators could claim immunity from that sort of inquiry and not be drawn in.
And that would no doubt be a subject of great debate in the case, Your Honor, but then how is the evidence going to be developed and presented to make it a jury question?
It's a circumstantial question from the evidence of what happened before the bribe and what happened after the bribe.
Well, although legislators might be able to oppose it, Your Honor, on an immunity ground, that sort of discovery of them, it may still be the case that a lot of legislators are brought in by both sides to testify. That's why I think Fletcher versus Peck means you cannot go there on a proximate cause. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. McKenna. So, Mr. Gray or Mr. Andelman, any further?
Your Honors, to respond to a couple of the points that Mr. Feinerman made, the casinos are soon to get their money back, but they're soon to get the money back from private parties, from the tracks. And that's why this case is nothing like the refund cases that they've cited.
Well, as to the 2008 law, however, that money is sitting in the protest fund.
That's true, but we haven't asked for the treasurer to give us that money, and we aren't going to ask. If you look at the complaint, the prayer for relief, we are only asking for monies in the possession of the tracks or claims that they have to that money. And procedurally, the way this case unfolded is we filed, we had briefing on motions to dismiss. We only moved for an injunction when we learned that the treasurer was imminently going to release the money, and then the injunction was only against the tracks. So we haven't involved the treasurer. The district court asked the treasurer to be present through the attorney general, and the attorney general said, you know, we didn't raise any objection, didn't have any issue.
So if you prove your case, if and when the treasurer pays the money out of the protest funds or protest fund, it's impressed with the constructive trust and comes to you.
We would be moving to modify the injunction at that point to cover those monies. Concerning the supposed controls on the tracks, they've made the argument today and they made it in the briefs that the statute somehow tightly controls what they do with this money. But they always minimize that last clause in the statute, which is, or otherwise operate their tracks. So if part of the operations of the tracks were to pay dividends to shareholders, they could use the money for that. If part of it was to give huge raises to all of the managers, they could use the money for that. This unquestionably is money that is designed to increase the profitability of these racetracks. Any private business that receives a windfall of what will be in excess of $100 million, is going to become more profitable. So, and that's really what's happening, is this: it is a transfer of wealth from one industry to another, and our industry has also been hurt. There was evidence at the preliminary injunction hearing, I think it's in Exhibits 4 and 5 there, and it's discussed in the transcript, that our industry has suffered a 30% decline in gross revenues over the last 2 years. Everyone's hurting. That's not the point. I think Judge Cannelli said, I guess everyone wants money. We get that. Every industry could use it. But that's not really the issue. The key point that I'd like to leave the court with on the Tax Injunction Act issue is, even if it is a tax, because we spent a lot of time today talking about whether it's a tax, even if it is a tax, it still wouldn't implicate the Tax Injunction Act, because the equitable relief we seek has no impact on the fiscal operations of the state of Illinois. And what the Tax Injunction Act has always been held to do is, it doesn't preclude federal courts from reviewing state statutes or even from stopping the implementation of a state statute. What it precludes is a federal injunction impacting the fiscal operations of a state or local taxing body. And
well,
the injunction
this,
we seek doesn't
statute,
do that.
Could this statute have been enjoined before the money was collected?
Could it have been enjoined before the money was collected? In other words, could we have moved for an injunction to prevent the payment of it? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I'd have to really think about it. We specifically waited not to move to enjoin until the money was going to be in private hands, because we didn't want this issue. And we were frankly surprised. And I think Judge Cannelli was surprised when they first raised it in the TRO hearing. He said, I don't understand. This money's been levied, assessed, and collected. Now it's been paid to you. So how does it implicate the Tax Injunction Act on its face? And I just don't think that it does.
Is this a general proposition about the Tax Injunction Act, that as long as that you can challenge any tax, any state tax, as long as you wait until the money has been disbursed?
Here's the general proposition. It's that you can challenge any tax or any other statute as long as it doesn't impact the fiscal operations of the state.
That question directly.
Well, because I think I have to rephrase it a little.
Any tax in the form of simply seeking to impose a constructive trust on whatever money was distributed as a result of the tax. So if you were challenging the Medicaid program, say the state taxes on whatever they support their share of Medicaid expense, you could sue the doctors, the patients, and so on, because that wouldn't interfere. Because once the money is dispersed, I think you're saying, once the money is dispersed, federal legal proceedings don't have any effect on state FISC.
The difference there is those doctors provided a service. They have to be paid for that service. So if you enjoin it, then you create it.
Charge the patients the cost of the service. They got the service for free by virtue of the Medicaid subsidy. So now you have some, defendant's class action where you try to get the money back from the patients.
The doctors are entitled to be paid.
The doctors are paid, but the point is the patients got a free service by virtue of this subsidy. So now we're going to make the patients pay back.
No, I guess I don't follow the example, Your Honor. I feel like that's so far afield from what isn't before the court.
I'll explain the example. It's extremely simple. Suppose the government, state government, imposes a tax on casinos, we'll say, and it's to help fund the Medicaid program. So doctors are paid to provide free services to poor people. Okay? So now the poor people have received the benefit of this casino tax to support Medicaid. Now, in principle, I'm not talking about the practicalities of it, if the casinos were to bring a suit against the patients, saying you received these free services under an illegal tax scheme then...
Well, they may be seeking a constructive trust over. They don't have any money.
Yes, in principle, right? In principle.
In practice, they don't all they have is we would be seeking a constructive trust over their money equal to the value.
You're not accepting. All right, well, I'll give you another example then. Suppose this casino tax is used to support unemployment benefits for people. And could you, and these people get unemployment benefits, they're not rich people, obviously, but they do have some money. And could the casinos, challenging this as an illegal tax on some basis, could they say, well, we're just going to try to get the money back from the recipients of the benefits. We're not going to try to enjoin the collection. We're going to wait till the people have the benefits, then we'll try to get the benefits back from them, and in that way we won't interfere with the it'll have no implications for the state's treasury.
See, I think in that circumstance, what the difference is, and it may be the court just doesn't accept my distinction, but the difference is that in that situation, the state has said to those unemployed people, in fact it says to all people in the state, if you become unemployed, we will give you this benefit. Here, the state,
look, you're not following. I'm talking about a procedural point, not a substantive point. I thought you suggested earlier that any tax could be challenged without the obstacle of the Tax Injunction Act, as long as you're not trying to enjoin the collection of the tax, you're just trying to take back the proceeds of the tax from whoever was the beneficiary.
Now, what I said was, and this goes back to the Supreme Court's decision in Hibbs, is the Tax Injunction Act only applies if it impacts the money of the state.
So why isn't your answer then, by virtue of Hibbs, as long as the lawsuit is against the recipients of the tax, of the subsidy that was financed by the tax, as long as it doesn't try to enjoin the collection of the tax, it's not barred by the Tax Injunction Act?
I think that would be my answer, subject to the I'm just not one part of that hypothetical I don't understand, which is I think the state has the obligation to pay that benefit. The state, the way the statute was structured, the state has not assumed an obligation to the tracks. It is a complete pass-through. Unlike the examples you're giving, where the state has assumed an obligation, collected money, and then distributed it.
It's still a pass-through, and I thought your point was that as long as you're not trying to enjoin the collection of the tax, but just trying to get the money back, that there's no Tax Injunction Act.
Well, that's certainly true, but it's true because it doesn't impact the fiscal operations of the state.
That would be true regardless of the nature of the tax and subsidy.
If the state has no obligation involved, because if the state,
your point, I thought, was that once the money has been paid out to the private people, getting that money back from the private people can't hurt the state.
Just not that simple.
It's already collected the money and distributed it.
It's not that simple, because if the state has an obligation, then even though you might be getting the money from those individuals, you may be creating claims against the state in the situation where there's an entitlement. If you don't have a state entitlement and you collect the money from private parties, then you aren't creating any obligation to the state. So it doesn't even have that indirect impact. That's all I'm trying to get at.
If I were you at this stage of the game, I'd run back and sit down.
That's my plan. Thank you, Your Honor.
So that's it. So thank you very much to both sides. Move on to our third case, Venisi versus Commission.